Nice to it is nice to have you, Gabriel Wagner, in Paris, and we're quite happy to discuss with you not only about the paper you're going to present in the seminar, but also more broadly about your conception of a moral normative philosophy. Could you say for a start a few words about how you came to be interested in the theme of sovereign debt?
Yeah, sure. One reason, of course, was that the issue of sovereign debt figured prominently on the news in the aftermath of the financial crisis starting in 2007. In the newspapers, you could read about Greece, you could read about Argentina, important events with tremendous ramifications for the livelihood of people. In Argentina, for example, unemployment rates went up as a consequence of Argentina's default on its sovereign debt. Unemployment rates went up, inflation skyrocketed, and so on. But surprisingly, political philosophers had very little to say about the moral and political philosophy issues involved in questions or issues of sovereign debt. So there was a bit of a silence on the side of political philosophy. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the moral arguments put forward in a political context or a political arena struck me as very unconvincing. If you look at the Greek sovereign debt crisis, for example, politicians, the German Minister of Finance, for example, made statements like, debt has to be repaid, period. Accept that as a norm. Agreements have to be kept, debt has to be repaid. There's no further debate about a haircut or debt relief and so on.
Is what in your paper you call the orthodox position, or the status quo position on sovereign debts. So could you be a bit more specific on this status quo position that says that debts have to be repaid full stop? Where does it come from? Why has it always been the case that sovereign debts were handled in this way? Or is it something new associated with the European Union?
So I think the norm of pacta sunt servanda, agreements have to be kept, that's an important norm in international law. It's not just informing the sovereign debt regime, but it also matters in other domains, other areas of international law. The sovereign debt regime, as it currently exists, has historically emerged and took its current form, I think, over the past 30, 35 years, with the main form of financing for states if they become debtors is through bonds. So states issue bonds, which are then bought by investors. And if they can't service the bond payments anymore, they either enter a state of sovereign default, or they try to restructure their debt. They try to negotiate with their creditors about paying less or about paying at a later time. But the sovereign debt regime as it exists is very chaotic, costly, and skewed.
So what is wrong with it, basically, and what could be the alternative to this sovereign debt regime?
So I think what's wrong with it is, first, there's chaos, right? A lack of structure, a lack of system. It's a very fragmented bargaining process that takes place between the debtor country, Argentina or Greece, and its various different creditors. The creditors are organized in Paris, in a Paris club, if they are sovereign creditors, in London clubs, if they are private creditors. And it's a messy bargaining process in which usually the creditors are in a stronger bargaining position. You could see this in the situation of Argentina. Argentina defaulted in the year 2000. I think that was at that point the biggest default in history. They entered a process of restructuring, renegotiating their debt with private and sovereign creditors, with the IMF and others. An agreement was reached at a certain point in time, but then these so-called holdout investors appeared.
Could you explain this point? Because I found it very interesting, but I'm not a specialist in the field, so that was a bit complicated for me to understand how, on the one side, there was already a renegotiation that had taken place, but those other bankers came into the game with this judgment in a court in New York that basically, if I got it right, forced Argentina to pay all the debts, whatever discussions they had been before. So how come?
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated... I'm not an economist myself, so it's the philosophy perspective, trying to make sense of what's going on in public policy and finance. So I think the problem, as I understand it, was Argentina had many creditors. They negotiated a restructuring and exchange of debt instruments with some. So say you hold a bond that I issued, I should repay $100. We negotiate that I only pay you back 50 because I can't pay back the full amount. But there isn't only you, there are also many, many others. So we negotiate an agreement, maybe I even negotiate an agreement with the majority of bondholders, which in theory should be binding for everyone, also the other creditors. But then these other creditors who bought the impaired bond on the so-called secondary market, they bought the bond after the restructuring had already started, they showed up and they demanded the full repayment. They said, oh, we're not satisfied with the $50, we want the full $100, $100 back. And then the courts ruled that Argentina has to pay the $100 to these others, to the so-called holdout investors, which again meant big financial trouble for Argentina. But it took ages. It took almost 15 years until the debt saga of Argentina was finally settled, coming with tremendous economic costs for the people of Argentina, a stronger bargaining position for the creditors, a very chaotic and, I said, costly and skewed process for both parties involved, actually. But the underlying normative assumption was pacta sunt servanda, agreements have to be kept, debt has to be repaid. That's, I think, the normative orthodoxy in the context of sovereign debt.
You say you're not an economist, but you're a philosopher. So could you tell us a bit more about what it means to be a normative philosopher entering the field of finance, or it could also be entering the field of taxation, because you're also interested in taxation. You've written all the papers on this topic. So what does it mean, and why, according to you, we definitely need the input of normative philosophers on those matters?
Yeah. So as somebody working in normative political theory or philosophy, you ask different questions than the questions the economist would ask, right? So you're interested in questions of justice. What would a just solution be? What would a just process of restructuring, for example, look like? So it helps if you understand the economics, if you have an understanding of what's going on. Say you are an informed consumer of the finance and economics part of the newspaper. Maybe you can read an economics textbook or understand the basics at least of what is going on. But you ask different questions, and there are things which you might find fishy, or where you start thinking about from the point of view of a philosopher. So here's an example, maybe. So pacta sunt servanda, agreements have to be kept. That intuitively seems like a perfectly fine norm. If we make an agreement to meet for lunch at a certain time, I better keep the agreement, right? Agreements have to be kept. Now, I think the mistake that politicians, maybe economists, maybe lawyers make is they take this norm, which seems to be a perfectly fine norm in an interpersonal context, and just straightforwardly assume that the same norm applies where the parties interacting aren't actually individuals. It's not you and me, but it's different sovereign states, or even multilateral institutions, the European Union, the IMF, and a state. But if you think about it properly, many complications arise if you just take the norm from an individual context and apply it in a context where collective actors like states are the relevant players. And it's not at all clear that the norm keeps its normative force. The number of complications that come up.
Could you be more specific on those complications and explain why or how the present international system in matters of debts could be reformed along the lines of justice and normative preoccupations?
Yeah. So here's one of the complications that arises with the norm of pacta sunt servanda, and then in the second step, I said a little bit about the reform prospects. So if you go to the bank, you take out a loan, and you agree that you repay the loan in 10 years' time, you are the one who takes out the loan, you are the one who's obligated to repay the loan, and you are benefiting in the meantime. You buy a house, let's say. But if you look at the state, the story is much more complicated. Who exactly is obligated to repay the loan, the bond in 10 years' time? Probably the citizenry through taxation. The state taxes its citizens, and that's how the state repays the loan in the future. But the composition of the citizenry will have changed over the course of 10 years. So it's different people who are obligated in the future than those who exist at present times, and maybe even different people if you take a long time perspective who benefit in the meantime. So the model of you entered the agreement, you benefited, and then you're obligated to repay doesn't travel straightforwardly to the international context. So I think it's actually a mistake to just think that Pacta sunt servanda applies in the context of sovereign debt, whatever its merits in the interpersonal context where individuals interact with others.
So it means also, if I get you right, that the individual people in this country, let's say Greece, which was at the center of our discussions in Europe in the past years, that individual Greek citizens may raise complaints against their state or against the European Union or against the international system. So the fact that those individuals can raise complaints is not enough. Is it possible just to make all those complaints or use those complaints within a more general model for assessing international policies or assessing, for example, an agreement between European states or banks, IMF, and the Greek government?
Yeah, so this is one of the ideas of the paper that's presented at the seminar. So you're asking the question, we have this sovereign debt regime that exists, and it's unconvincing. There are deficits in many respects. So one question is, what could an alternative sovereign debt regime actually look like? What are the right policies? What are the right institutions to deal with sovereign borrowing and lending? And what to do in a situation where a country is on the brink of defaulting? How to replace the status quo with some alternative? Now, one way to think about this problem is to apply what's called the complaint model, a model originally suggested by contractualists like Tim Scanlon as a general framework for figuring out what's right and wrong. But I think you can also take this model and apply it to a context where what matters is the design of hands-on institutions of, for example, international financial governance. So instead of asking the question, what institutional setup would generate the greatest benefits overall instead of maximizing the prospects for positive benefits, you ask a slightly different question and you say, so imagine we have the status quo and some alternative. What are the complaints that individuals could raise against going for the alternative or maintaining the status quo? What is the complaint an individual could raise, for example, because they are adversely affected by the status quo or the alternative? It may have an impact on their well-being, on what they can do as individuals who are investing money or saving money or borrowing money, or on them as citizens who are citizens of a state who suffers from the problem of high public indebtedness and so on. So you'd have a complaint, say an Argentinian citizen would have a complaint against sticking with the status quo and not moving on to some alternative. Say somebody who is invested in a hedge fund who's holding Argentinian bonds would have a complaint against an alternative system which makes restructuring easier and shifts bargaining power towards the debtor country, towards Argentina. You ask the question, who would have the bigger complaint? And you go for the option that has the smallest, biggest complaint. You minimize the biggest complaint that anyone has, and that's the preferred policy outcome. So my argument is, if you think
just on this, if you allow me for this further question, sure, on this or follow up question, how can you say that, because we're in a period of social unrest right now with the Gilets Jaunes movement in France and in many other countries, how can you evaluate or measure the I would say intensity or importance of a complaint? Because you say the bigger complaint. But what is the dimension according to which you make the measure?
Yeah, so a number of issues matter, right? So first is, what exactly is the dimension or the metric in which you measure the complaint? The generic notion you could apply is it matters how an institution or policy affects individual interests. The next question then obviously is, what sort of interests are the relevant interests? What interests matter? I think well-being interests are important. Other interests, which you could call agency interests, also matter.
Or what you call also autonomy interests.
Autonomy interests, what you can do as an individual or as a collective in terms of collective self-determination, in terms of individual self-determination. And you can see how one policy may have a positive or a negative effect on your autonomy or on your well-being.
And this is very important, this point, because you also add up to that as a third element of comparison, justice. And sometimes people have difficulties considering they're focused on well-being interest. So could you say, would you agree to say that one of the interests of normative political philosophy would be to be able to take into considerations a variety of interests that would not only be well-being interests?
Yeah, so I think justice is important in addition to mere well-being interests. If you think about how justice matters in the context of sovereign debt, for example, I think what is at stake is the following. So you have an interest in living in a just society. There will be disagreement about what exactly a just society looks like, but let's take as an uncontroversial candidate Thoreauian theory of justice with its difference principle. Say inequalities are just only if the inequalities improve the situation of the worst off in society. Fairly ambitious principle of justice. Now, state institutions may be better or worse in putting this principle of justice into practice. And I think sovereign borrowing and lending matters greatly for a state's ability to actually put a principle of justice, not just the difference principle, but any principle of justice into practice. Right? So you have an economic downturn. For example, you think it's important to keep people in employment, to improve the situation of the worst off. You don't want to raise taxes because you are in a difficult economic situation already. What you'll have to do as a state is go to international financial markets, borrow money, use it, invest it, and so on to secure justice, to put justice into practice in your domestic context.
In the present situation, because President Macron talked yesterday and just trying to... And indeed, I mean, one of the solutions seemed to be just to give more money to the people who are needing the money. So he's taking into consideration the well-being dimension of the problem. But is he really taking into consideration the two other elements, which are autonomy, giving more agency to the people? And could you be more specific on that? And also justice considerations that tend to be or seem to be also at the center of the discussion and of the unrest. So, and sometimes in matters of finding more funding, well, we're within the European Union, so how do you do? I mean, sometimes...
I don't want to get too much into the details of French politics. Also, I don't know what exactly
Macron
said last night.
That was just an example, to characterize more the difference between the three criteria. And what means of politics that would take into consideration also this problems of autonomy, agency, that the people, agency, I need to use my car to go to, it's a problem of agency to a certain extent, is it?
Yeah, so using your car, mobility might be an important component of individual autonomy, right? And this may in part explain the fury underpinning the current French unrest that comes with. You may think, why is a tiny increase on a tax on petrol or gas that big of an issue? Maybe it is an important issue because it has an impact on your autonomy interests. If you live on the countryside, if you have to use a car to get around, go to the doctors and so on, then it matters that you can afford using your car. To distinguish more between the well-being dimension and the justice dimension, an easy proxy, maybe too simple a proxy for well-being could be GDP growth and so on, but that ignores the question of how growth or GDP is distributed within the population, right? This raises questions of justice. I mean, you could have high growth rates, high GDP levels, but these being distributed very unevenly within the population, giving rise to questions of distributive justice. And of course, sovereign debt, to return to that topic, or the existing sovereign debt regime, has important ramifications, not only for the ability of the state to put a conception of justice into practice through fiscal policy, taxation, and so on, but also has direct distributive consequences for who is how well off within domestic societies. And I think all these three things matter when it comes to morally evaluating a sovereign debt regime.
You wrote a very interesting review of The Capital in 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. Could you just tell us your analysis of the book? Why and also the reasons why the economics of inequality suddenly came to the fore? Whether, as we know, I mean, that was not Piketty's first book, which was not so well read. So what happened in between? And that explains then the importance of inequality in the discussion, political discussion. Yeah.
So this may actually be one of the occasions where the philosophers were quicker than the economists, because there are huge debates about the value of equality or the problem of inequality in political philosophy. And actually, this ebbed down the discussion in political philosophy, when then suddenly there was Piketty with the book making a big splash and so on. But I think the content of the book also explains its success, right? Growing inequality, at least within domestic societies of the OECD countries that Piketty analyzed, growing inequality is an important issue. So my take on the book was again, not an economist, I take the econometrics and the economic history and so on for granted. Extremely interesting results using historical tax data, advanced econometric techniques to arrive at the insights or verdicts that he arrived at. But I think there are a number of interesting normative questions, not only normative questions that Piketty's finding give rise to, but I think some normative questions one could helpfully ask before looking at the data that Piketty collected. So Piketty is not very explicit about why the inequality that he diagnoses is actually problematic from a moral point of view or the point of view of justice. So I think in different passages he says different things. It's undermining the meritocratic ideal underpinning capitalism. If wealth is inherited, it's not that you actually earned it or that you performed well. The meritocratic ideal is not reflected in the inequalities that he diagnoses. In other passages, there seems to be a worry about the stability of society. If inequality becomes too great, then societies become unstable. A worry about the functioning of democratic institutions. If there's too much inequality, what does that mean for the functioning of a democracy? Now, you can probably add to the list. There are other reasons to be worried about inequality. Now, I'm not sure whether you would always arrive at the verdicts at which Piketty arrives, depending on why exactly you think that inequality is problematic. So the take of the 1% is maybe problematic if you worry about inequality from the point of view of meritocracy, say. But other inequalities may take or go to the fore if you worry about inequality for different reasons. So the disappearance of the middle class may be a problem, but not exactly clear for what reasons exactly. Now, if you think about it from the point of view of equality, it's a society in which you have people at the bottom end and then a middle class. Is that better in terms of equality than a society in which you have a very few people at the top and no middle class and then people at a lower level? So Piketty assumes, of course, the 1% society with a disappeared middle class, that's a society of greater inequality. But I think once you start asking questions about why exactly inequality is problematic, you may arrive at a different picture.
So you would be your position would be more along the line of the position of Ari Frankfurt, who would say that in the end, I mean, inequalities don't matter so much, but what is important is that everybody has enough.
No, quite the opposite, actually. I think that equality is an important value, that many inequalities are problematic exactly because they are unfair. So I would subscribe to the more ambitious, sometimes called luck egalitarian principle, that nobody should be worse or better off than anybody else through no fault or choice of his or her own. It's not just important that everyone has enough, but inequalities, even beyond the level of sufficiency, matter, because these inequalities, for example, because these inequalities are unfair.
Brings me to another question about the present direction of your work. I mean, one other direction of your work is, if I got you right, concerns non-orthodox Marxism. And as we know, Gerald Cowen was one of the founding figure of analytic Marxism. So could you be more specific on why this non-orthodox Marxism has many things to tell us today?
Yeah. So I think there is a more academic reason and a more practical reason. Just thinking about it from the point of view of academic interest, I think there's an important strand in Marxism which has been neglected by the analytical Marxists. They've worked on Marx's theory of history, for example, on the notion of exploitation. It developed into the lack egalitarian debate that we just mentioned. Many of the analytical Marxists got involved in this. But I think there are interesting elements, for example, in the early Marx and in Western Marxism, more standardly associated with the critical theory tradition, that it is worth looking at again with the tools of analytic political philosophy at hand. Notions like alienation, reification, themes from the early Marx, but also from a not strictly speaking Marxist tradition, but more of the tradition associated with anarchism. Figures like Bakunin, Kropotkin, Proudhon, as a French figure. And for some reason, analytical Marxism never really took off, right? So Marxism was revisited from the analytic point of view in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. But there was nothing comparable going on with regards to anarchism. So just out of academic curiosity, it would be interesting to read these classics and see whether there's anything convincing that could be developed as systematically as analytical Marxism from the point of view of contemporary and political philosophy.
If you had to take just one concept, because we're coming to the end of our interview, one concept among the concepts developed by Proudhon, Kropotkin, and the anarchist thinkers, what would it be? Where would you start this program? Because if I got you right, it's a program, ongoing program. So what would be the essential concept you would like to tackle in an analytic manner?
So I think one concept that is important and that could inform also a politically interesting conception of socialism is the concept of agency or political agency, free and rational agency. What does it mean for individuals to act for the reasons that they have? What does it mean for individuals to act rationally and autonomously? And what are the social institutions that make it possible for individuals to act as free and rational agents? I think from that point of view, you can develop an interesting and promising critique of capitalism. The institutions of capitalism make free and rational action impossible. And you can also think about what alternative institutions would look like. How would we have to organize our economy? How would we have to organize our political life to make it possible for individuals to act free and rationally? I think it's important that individuals can act with others in the right ways to secure the conditions of free individual rational agency. What do these institutions look like? Would they be compatible with markets? Would they be compatible with private property and the means of production? Would they be compatible with state institutions as we know them? The anarchism enters the picture again. So I think if you look at agency, an interesting perspective opens up. There was a recent paper by John Roemer in Philosophy and Public Affairs from last year where he says the ideal of socialism has to be revised. Historically, Marxists or socialists have been concerned with exploitation and the elimination of exploitation. He thinks that's a mistake. You have to look at radical equality of opportunity. So he says socialism should be understood as radical socialist equality of opportunity. I think there's a third interesting conception, that socialism as free and rational agency.
And my last question would be about, I mean, you're teaching, so you have been teaching in Berlin, you now move to Beirut. Could you just tell us something about how you think the agency of students in higher education and maybe in your new university or in the Humboldt could be implemented? What could we do, I mean, as scholars or professors in philosophy just to try and educate our students in the direction of more agency?
So I think different levels matter, right? One thing is what happens in the classroom. How do you interact with students? What formats do you use when you actually teach? Do you actually succeed in meeting your students eye to eye? And here I think philosophy is very interesting disciplines, right? Because even first year students sometimes make arguments that are pretty good arguments and arguments that speak against your position and where you have to admit, oh, it doesn't work as I imagined. Good point. So I think studying or teaching philosophy is very promising in this respect. Another issue is what exactly do you teach? What are the topics that you teach? What belongs into a political philosophy curriculum? Be sensitive to the concerns that students have. Don't teach the classics up and down. Of course, the classics have to be taught, but maybe there are other takes or issues that cater more for issues that are of pressing concern to students, for example.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.